Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 76, we're at the studios of the ABC in Sydney, where we'll be discussing, among other things, the geopolitics of Asia-Pacific and Australia's defence spending spree.
The code in the 2009 white paper is saying this neighbourhood is unstable, there are a lot of problems here, and we can foresee situations where we are going to have to go in again.
That was Andrew Shearer, Director of Studies at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. And is Sydney a good place to launch a bespoke tailoring business for Australia's nattiest men?
You have to forge all these good relationships over in Europe, so you've got to go and do that and then come back. It's very hard to start here from scratch.
That was Taylor Patrick Johnson. And later in the show, we'll be hearing from Monocle regular and one of our favourite chefs, Bill Granger, live and in person in the city where it all started.
What's interesting in Australia is that we don't have a sense of foreign food. Even in the UK, you get a sense of foreignness. You don't have that here. The food becomes very much a part of who we are.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 24th, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in, surprise, surprise, Sydney. I'm Tyler Brûlé, with a host of lovely Sydney Siders, but without Andrew Tuck or Robert Bound. This week, we decided to throw the format, or at least my colleagues, out the window and do the show on the fly while whizzing through Australia. On the plane down from Singapore, we discuss whether we should co-anchor the weekly out of Sydney and London, but producer Alexander Mills suggested we try an edition without nets or wires, so here I am, all alone in the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Sydney's Ultimo District. Well, almost. Alex thought I should have some sort of spotter, so we invited along a very special guest to kick things off. She's had a remarkable career in publishing, having stewarded some of Australia's greatest magazines, and also the daunting task of kicking Condé Nast's Russian titles into shape. Before heading back to Australia, however, her last port of call was Monocle headquarters, where she was my sparring partner, investment banker, and agony aunt during the launch of our little venture. She's now keeping various businesses and bodies in shape here in Australia, but we still miss her dearly in London, and it's great to welcome Robin Holt to The Weekly. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm terrific. I'm all the better for seeing you.
I can't believe it's been a long time that we've seen each other, but it's been 4 years since I've been to Australia, and it was incredible coming off the plane yesterday and on one side seeing that, you know, very little has changed, which I'm not sure if it's a good or bad thing. But also, I think, you know, at the same time, you just feel completely sort of immersed in lifestyle Australia when you get here. And I'm wondering what it's been like being back. I mean, you're not fresh off the turnip truck. You've been back for a while now.
A couple of years. I've got to say, I felt exactly the same as you did. I got off the plane and I thought, have we been in a freeze zone here? What's happened? But then you start to actually peel back the layers, and there's lots that has changed. I think the instant thing that hits you is the clarity of the colour of the sky, the sunshine. I have some English friends here who say, not another great day. You know, I think everybody gets worn down by the perfectness of it. But yeah, it's a very strange feeling, Sydney. Someone once described it as a resort and a city wrapped into one, and that's exactly what it is.
And coming back, you're, you know, on a real sort of, you know, media roller coaster, leaving here, then sort of jumping into, you know, a major, you know, adventure in Moscow, and then, you know, something which was, you know, even beyond an adventure when we were getting this little project up and rolling. I'm wondering, you know, coming back, because I think probably when you left, you know, Australian media was in such an interesting place. It was really sort of defining. And, it, you know, it, I think, you know, I've always sort of said, you know, the Australians, you know, really created California culture. When you really sort of think about that sort of true approach to sort of indoor-outdoor living, mm-hmm. when you think about the great modern architecture, when you think about the food and really what it means to sort of, you know, be Pacific, you know, and also sort of, you know, on the doorstep of Asia, you know, it goes sort of far beyond California. And there was such a moment, and I guess, you know, you were very much part of it, you know, just, you know, everything that Condé Nast was doing down here with Vogue Entertaining, with Living, and, you know, even Vogue itself, it really defined a moment. But you came back and things are at a slightly different
Very
point.
Different.
Where do things sit media-wise right now, Robin?
I think it's sort of sad on one level, because what you talked about there was a lot of innovation. And that was the most remarkable thing, to actually pick up and really recognise food, entertaining, you know, which Vogue Entertaining and Travel, in fact, was one of the inspirations that Martha Stewart said that she used when she started her magazine. So what happened is a lot of that innovation sort of got washed away as people kept, you know, crumbling those into empires. So now what we're left with...
are crumbled empires.
Well, I can't really define it on that level, but we're left with really three players in the magazine area. Condé Nast actually decided to go back into a license, which was a very, you know, it had to happen. It needed a larger capital base to operate from. So that was given to Hannon, and Hannon then sold to News Limited. So in fact, rather curiously, it's ended up in Rupert Murdoch's backyard. So News Limited have got all of their magazines. Then ACP, as you know, which is, you know, part of the Packer organisation, sort of sold out at a rather pivotal time, very good time for the for the television, not so good for the magazine empire. And that's run by merchant bankers and investment bankers. And you know what they're like, you know, where's the return, where's the return? So there's been a lot of cutting going through there. And when you get that sort of mentality, you lose that innovation and creativity. So there's that empire. And then there's Kerry Stokes, the other Kerry, as they say. He, of course, has the television of Channel 7, which is leading the pack at the moment in free-to-air, and Pacific Magazines. So you've got three camps, and in those three camps, I don't see any new or great spirit that you're talking about. And a lot of it, I think, is due to the fact that everybody is actually now thrusting the bottom line. But look at what the ad industry is doing. In fact, what is happening now is I think you'll see a great lift back into advertising, which also then releases, if you like, some money back into creativity.
Now, in case our listeners are wondering, if you're now editing a pet magazine, all that jingling and jangling in the background is not sort of a pair of French bulldogs. It's all those jewels from the mines that you own way out in the outback. But if you look at things now, I mean, you know, Australia sits at, you know, at a really interesting point. The economy is booming. You know, we're off the back of a week, you know, much celebration that, you know, we've got, well, I say we, maybe I'm sort of, you know, heading for my passport as well down here, but that there's, you know, parity with the US dollar, sort of, you know, much excitement about that. But, you know, also this was a part of the world that, you know, really emerged largely, you know, unscathed, you know, by the crisis that hit the rest of the world. But I'm wondering what that means for Brand Australia, Robin, because you know, those magazines and, you know, and I think even the role that the newspapers had, you know, they were so important as real cultural exports and defining this as an interesting place to go. Because lots of people can look at tourism campaigns and they can sort of be attracted by price offers by airlines, but it is sort of buying into that lifestyle. And I think people always want to sort of see, God, you know, what is the fantasy like if I chose to live in Melbourne or if I chose to live in Sydney? Do you see it coming back? Is there, you know, because the economy has been good, is there a spirit of entrepreneurialism that might give rise to new media, or do people, I say this as a Canadian as well, do they go and seek greener pasture somewhere else and choose not to do it here?
I think it's a really interesting question, Tyler, because I think we're all standing back waiting for it. The dollar at parity is good for us, but it isn't good for tourism. You know, when you're actually really looking at costing out coming down here, it's a hell of a lot of money. And we very much depend on that tourism. So that tourism dollar is not going to be there. That actually slightly changes the dynamic of what you're producing. I don't know. I always think there's room for a great magazine in the marketplace. I still think people are readers, but I think it has to be delivered in a way where you do have things that are fresh and new. I think that the whole world of apps is a very interesting one going forward, and a magazine should actually perhaps have part of its physical, which is that wonderful thing, and then part of its whole electronic, which is what you're doing with Monocle. The whole, you know, how you want your message, how you want it delivered, is actually delivered in a place that actually feels good for you. I don't think our media are exploring that. But I think what's really interesting is I see great books coming out of here, which is for the first time ever that I've actually started to see great coffee table books. The book that I was involved with, Residents, actually shows lifestyle to not just be beach, shack and holiday, but a much more sophisticated lifestyle. And I think that's where we're starting to change our place in the world, that it is holiday, it is beach, it is sunshine, but it's also able to deliver to you a level of sophistication on many levels, retail levels, food levels, all of those things.
I mean, the one thing that strikes you is when you know, I only did a very sort of quick tour, you know, around the streets, but, you know, when, you know, spending time in Tokyo and Singapore and all the mm-hmm. European cities and you know certainly in North America, the one thing that strikes you is the absence of big international names. And I say that mm-hmm. as a positive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting how mm-hmm. Starbucks really got run out of town. I don't know how many outlets closed, but you know there's really only a handful in tourist places for people who don't know any better. And that's the exciting thing. You see all of these. I mean, just you know on the way to the studios this morning, just the sheer number of just tiny little owner operated cafes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which are all striving to make the best coffee, to attract the office workers, to attract people in the neighborhood. I mean, that's exciting. And I think sort of that vibrance and the energy of small business. And I mean, you know, it's always been part of the mantra of the magazine. You know,
absolutely.
we just, you know, we like this whole notion of people being able to do it themselves, to chart their own destiny. You know, is that sort of perhaps some of the social capital that really makes this place tick and is perhaps part of the future as well?
I do think it is. I think it's also a great energy for young people. There are so many things like, and I love this, the whole growers markets and all of those things. If you know, I heard that Bill's going to come into the studio in a moment, and I'm sure he'll have a lot more to say about it. It's all about that whole energy. If you want to do it, then you do it, you know, and I think that's what makes Australia really different. That encourages young people to come here because it is still the land of opportunity. If you want to start something small, you know, and when you talk about little cafes and pop-up cafes, I mean, we're such coffee snobs.
Yeah.
When we go overseas and, you know, when I went to London and someone said, this is a really great cup of coffee, I went, are you kidding me? I mean, no, it was hideous. But I've got to say that I think that that's where there's a lot of energy. If I was a young person coming here, there's anything that's a possibility. You can start a corner store, you can do a pop-up somewhere. And it's that, I think it's a young country. And from that, when you talk about it, growing, and actually I think it's the evolution of actually importing young energy and actually really looking at what it's got to offer.
Is the market big enough though? And certainly, you know, the reach that certainly the Monocle brand and this program has, I'm sure a lot of people are sort of listening, wondering, God, I would like to just cash in my chips and mm-hmm. head down there and mm-hmm. go down to Barrel and, you know, start a farm and raise some great cattle, etc., and then set up my butcher shop. And do you think that, you know, you talked about sort of the sophistication of the book that you're doing, and of course this is a very sophisticated market, but it ain't the biggest one, and it is perhaps one of the most remote in the world. I mean, given you know mm-hmm. scale aside, do you think it's still a hard go of it, or is there always cut through like anywhere else?
I think that you're always going to have a population issue. There's 21 million people here. And whether you like it or not, you work very hard to actually cut yourself out a small part of that. And therefore, that's why I think you don't have the big names here and the big companies here. Starbucks is just because they didn't make a great coffee. But I think, you know, when you start to look at the numbers and where you're sitting on Asia's doorstep, and if you were to cut the numbers out of Asia, why would you choose Australia? Australia
right.
is a lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
It's not a really viable big financial, I'm going to go down there and make $1 million and leave in a heartbeat. Doesn't work like that here. If I was going to cash in my chips in London, I'd probably still have to go back to London, though. I think it's 6 months here and 6 months there is the way to work it.
You think that's still the perfect lifestyle?
I do.
Yeah, no, I was feeling, I said, you know, this morning, the weather was a little bit sort of, it was, you know, I would say, you know, verging on shitty the other day. Oh, God, you know, and Alex, you know, our producer was, I thought, you know, this is his first trip to Australia. And I was thinking, you know, you wanted those big crystal clear skies when we got off the plane. And it just wasn't there. But it was there this morning. And it was just, you know, that feeling of just getting up, you know, throwing on your sneakers, running around the opera house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just, that magic never, it really never wears off, ever, ever, ever.
You can't beat it. You cannot beat it. But what I'm saying is what you do miss, and what I missed when I first moved back here, is the closeness of Europe. You know, where you can suddenly say, oh my gosh.
Where am I going to go in an hour?
Yeah, exactly. Or what a great exhibition in Berlin, let's go.
Yeah.
You don't have that. And that is something that you need to have an inject of. And as we've always said, once you go away, you refresh your eyes, you're always pleased to see the opera house through that small window in the plane.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing though, which does, you know, strike me, and I think maybe this is an advantage for Australia, and you know, not just sort of, you know, plugging, you know, the ABC, but you know, we look at in the UK right now, we're going to be talking a little bit later about the spending spree that's happening, you know, on the defense side in this country,
mm-hmm.
but also, you know, when you look at the ABC, you know, interesting cultural exports, you know, what Chris Lilley has done with some of his programs,
very funny,
and how, you know, in a way that sort of shown another aspect. I mean, you know, Australia's had a lot of good television, but this is something which has, you know, come from public broadcasting. Quite interesting in dynamic radio. I mean, so whether it's, you know, Triple J, which I guess has done out of this building, and also a commitment, I guess, on the part of, you know, having an Australian voice, you know, within Asia. And as you said, sort of, you know, being on Asia's doorstep, and, you know, whether that's sort of, you know, a voice of democracy and a voice of the free market and all of those types of things. Do you think that there's maybe some currency, you know, in that? And these are things which also, you know, Australia needs to continue to do as well, rather than, you know, of course, we hear about cutbacks at the CBC in Canada, the BBC, and I'm sure there's lots of axes probably swinging near here as well, I would imagine.
I think the ABC is a remarkable institution, has done incredibly well with 24-hour news that they've just done. They've
got on television, the news, yeah.
And also they've got a fantastic app which is free to download. And when I was speaking to Mark Scott, who's their managing director, he was saying that they have more than 700,000 people, you know, attuned to it. So I think they've been very proactive. I think in our media of making television, although it's very expensive, and I understand that, I think there's been real innovations made. I think that we know that we need to be more aggressive about getting into Asia. It's a step-by-step process, but we've got, if you like, a given marketplace sitting above us that I think that we need to work a little harder on penetration.
Because, you know, when you look at the programming, and not just, you know, ABC, but also, you know, one of the other affiliated state broadcasters, SBS, and it's the one thing that I tend to miss even sitting in London. You've got the proximity of all of the, you know, the European channels, but you get that sort of best of, and I think the Australians have always been very good, just because of the remoteness of whether it's cuisine, you know, whether it's sort of, you know, fashion, it's been able, the ability to do the pick and mix and the editing. And it is interesting looking at the programming. I think, you know, the way the news lineups go, the, you know, the music, it's just great seeing that SBS has a program which is just devoted, you know, primarily to Korean pop, Japanese pop, Mandarin pop. And, you know, and it runs as around the clock channel. And that's something which, you know, you don't see. You know, I don't see the BBC doing a program like that. You know, it sort of defaults to sort of one or two communities, but doesn't sort of have an embrace of an entire region. And that's really exciting, I think.
I think, I'm glad that you mentioned SBS, because they're my heroes at the moment, on the basis that they took a channel called Studio, which is, you know, run out of Foxtel. And they've devoted it to just arts. It's just an arts channel. So one day it's devoted to writing, the next day it's devoted to music, the next day it's devoted to dance, the next day. And you're right about editing. And they've taken some local, some that's foreign, some that's American, and they just put it all in English and they put it all together. And when I thought about how come this really works, I think because we've always been so far away, what we've had to do is rely on either lifting things or bringing things over or adapting things and then wrapping it in our own, you know, identity or nationality. And that's why I think we make great editors in every possible way, whether we're doing it to do with design, whether we're doing it with architecture. I think we take the very best that the world offers and then we wrap it with something that's actually known to look iconically Australian.
Well, yeah, and speaking of wrapping things and making them look iconically Australian, it's interesting how Canberra has also been on on this extraordinary spending spree. So I was going to say, you know, happy that you're sort of back on this island, you know, Rob, because I'm not sure how the UK is going to defend themselves off the back of last week and all the defense cuts. So, and it was great to see you. And I mean, hopefully that we're back soon and we can maybe establish a bit of a beachhead here as well.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely love that.
Okay. Good to see you, my dear.
Thank you.
Take care. Now, in a week that saw the heaviest round of cuts since the Cold War sliced through the UK's Ministry of Defence, Britain's generals and infantrymen would be forgiven for wanting to pack their bags for Australia. While the food and sunshine might be part of the draw, the bigger might be Australia's current spending spree on its armed forces. A new fleet of ships, a pair of aircraft carrier-style vessels, squadrons of new aircraft and new land vehicles are all on the shopping list as Australia seeks to bolster its position as regional superpower and policeman. The question is whether it's all necessary and can the country afford it? Andrew Shearer is the Director of Studies at Sydney's Lowy Institute of International Policy and he joins us here in studio. Welcome.
Hi, Tyler.
Just to start, looking at what happened in the UK over the last week, you know, quite remarkable that, you know, we were in a position probably 2 weeks ago, you know, would these two aircraft carrier be going ahead? Obviously, a lot of discussion where, you know, you see obviously casualty and certainly, you know, death. deaths, you know, really every week, or if not twice a week, when you watch sort of major bulletins, and an enormous story, and a lot of people saying, well, you know, either we're going to be in the fight or not. And I think that that's what this came down to. But then on the other side, as we're saying at the top of the program, well, the spending spree hasn't even just started. It's been going on for some time here. First, why? And, you know, aside from what we highlighted, what's on the list?
Well, I think, as you say, this trend goes right back to 2000. And basically what's happened is after the end of the Cold War, Australia, like lots of other places, reaped a peace dividend. We wound back our defence spending. We shrank our army. We didn't worry so much about exercises and all that sort of thing. We basically kind of kept the military ticking over. Still cost a lot, of course, but not as much as we're spending now. So along comes the end of the Cold War. Regional instability, problems in some of our neighbouring countries, East Timor, the Solomons, Fiji, all quite unstable. And then 9/11, of course. But it's important to point out when in 1996, John Howard and Peter Costello slashed the Australian budget deficit in the way that David Cameron's government's doing now.
Attempting.
In the UK.
Yep.
Attempting. What was quarantined right back then was defence. So the rest of government spending was cut and defence was left to one side. So the trend actually can be dated to there. Since 2000, 3% real growth every year, and that's projected to last right out till, I think, 2019.
What was there a specific wake-up call? Was it a reaction to, was it to Timor, or was it a combination of many things, or was there, you know, one specific event that certainly everyone in Canberra said, right, we have to, you know, obviously put some kind of fence around this?
Howard's initial decision in 96 was about instinct. It was about the gut instinct of a politician who, I think, foresaw somehow that we were heading into a more uncertain period. But East Timor was the big wake-up call. We led the intervention. It went very well. Everyone was happy. Good news story. Behind the scenes, though, senior politicians and military leaders knew that we got away with it just. And if it had been harder, we may not have got away with it. So in 2000, we start beefing up the army, buying long-range transport ships and planes and laying the blueprint for this new military, which the Rudd government continued in its white paper.
So we're really talking about something which is, you know, a white paper which looks really out to sort of 2030, and the role that Australia will, you know, I guess, you know, will play in interventions around the world, not just within the neighbourhood, let's say. So what spearheads it? I mean, I was sort of talking about, and it is remarkable to think that, you know, a country of 21, 22 million people, you know, will have two vessels, which are, you know, I guess, you know, certainly a military person maybe not wouldn't call them an aircraft carrier. Anyone else seeing them on the high seas would say they're aircraft carriers, you know, have as many as the UK will have, which is quite something. But do you think it's also sort of necessary, just given the position that Australia occupies in this part of the world?
I think that's right. Essentially, Tyler, we live in a fairly volatile neighbourhood, and I think that's the big difference, frankly, between us and the UK. Part of it is, of course, being able to contribute to US coalitions, and that's why we've put so much weight on being able to operate with the US, buying US platforms, etc., training with them. But at the heart of this is our own security, our own immediate neighbourhood, and that's why I think the code in the 2009 white paper, if you look very carefully at it, is saying this neighbourhood is unstable, there are a lot of problems here, and we can foresee situations where we are going to have to go in again.
On, let's say, the economics, I mean, there's two points to this, which is, of course, we'll come back to whether this is, you know, this is sustainable, because obviously, you know, many of these platforms haven't even been laid yet,
right.
And I'm sure the orders haven't even gone in yet. But just looking at Australia Incorporated, you know, is there also, you know, quite a big, let's say, stimulus side to all of this as well, that a part of also Australia being able to build up its own capabilities? Of course, many of these are joint ventures and they're licensed deals, etc., but also being able to supply internationally as well.
That's right. Keeping a high-tech defence industrial base as part of this, that's why when you look at the government's decision on submarines, they've made clear that building them in Australia is their goal. Now, that's very, very ambitious, and there's a lot of people around poo-pooing the idea we can get away with that. But I think that points to one of the motives for this, which is about keeping defence industry going, keeping factories working in marginal electorates, all the usual sort of political reasons, and keeping the ability to do this stuff here in Australia.
Manpower aside, and keeping you know, people employed in perhaps certainly less robust districts. Just the numbers. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we see sort of one part of the paper talking about, you know, I guess there's 6 submarines at the moment, going up to potentially a fleet of 12 submarines, 2 aircraft carriers, lots of support vessels, aircraft, everything. I mean, it is, it's certainly a force to be reckoned with that we're looking at. You know, will it be sustainable, though, when it comes time, no matter how strong your dollar is?
There are real doubts about this, I think, on two scores. The first one is human materiel. So one of the downsides of a robust economy is, ironically, that it's harder to recruit people to the ADF and harder to retain them in the ADF, in particular specialised trades. The submarine fleet and the surface navy have been hit by aggressive recruitment by the resources companies. They hire engineers and so forth, take them out to northwestern Australia and pay them, you know, 3 or 4 times as much. Quite an understandable choice for those people to make, but sure. A problem for the Navy. So, for example, today, Navy struggles to crew fully 2 submarines at any one time out of the 6. And if you're talking about 12, who knows how they're going to do that. The other one is financial. There's a 3% real growth built into the defence budget, but I think most experts think still that this is very ambitious. There's $20 billion of assumed savings over the next 10 years. We'll see. I'm a bit sceptical about that.
Is, looking at Afghanistan at the moment, the engagement that goes there, being able to be an expeditionary force is also very much part of the paper, I would imagine. And it seems also not even just with the neighbourhood, if things kicked off even in on the other side of the Pacific, in Latin America or something, if Australia was called upon, that they should be able to participate, correct?
That's right. Being part of broader coalition operations has been a driver of Australian strategy for more than 200 years, really. So I think you can expect to see more of that. But when we go further afield, it's much less likely that we'll be in the lead. So almost certainly, I think more likely than Latin America, North Asia, where our huge export markets are, lots of tensions up there, disagreements over territory, over resources, etc. Everyone hopes it doesn't happen, but some prospect at least of US-led military operations up there and a role for Australia in that.
If you look out, and you know, as we're coming towards the end of the year, and I'm sure there's lots of strategists and people sitting in Canberra, you know, always, being mindful of what potential flashpoints are, within the immediate vicinity, what are the flashpoints that you think certainly concern people, and obviously where Australia's forces are poised to deploy if necessary?
Some of them are the same old suspects, I'm afraid. East Timor, where we've still got soldiers. We've had outbreaks of violence there in 2006-07 and again in 2008. And much as the current government talked about demilitarising Australia's policy in the South Pacific, it's interesting that when violence broke out, their response was very much the same, which was get more troops on the ground and tamp things down. So those will be places to watch. Fiji too, where as a result of the coup, the country's been marginalised, the economy's in deep trouble, who knows where that's going. And then I think something that's been growing quietly but is coming to the fore and starting to bubble is the whole question of maritime security in, say, the South China Sea, which is not too far from us and which carries most of our trade to North Asia, the East China Sea, and growing signs of competition too in the Indian Ocean. So real signs of a kind of incipient naval contest right between India and all the way up to Korea.
Finally, there's obviously been a lot of discussion about the Japanese and certainly Australian planners have been sort of back and forth between Canberra and Tokyo as well. Is this also as much as we sort of heard the Japanese also recognizing that they, for many political reasons, they need to be independent as well from the United States. Is there that sentiment here as well that probably Australia would never act unilaterally, but it also needs strong relationships that also exist outside of the sphere of influence of the United States?
I think there's an element of that, but it's not the main driver. I think the main driver is Japan's feeling anxious, it's feeling insecure, and it's looking for new partners. Australia, too, is sensing this shift of power in Asia. There are worries in some minds, at least, about the long-term sticking power of the US in Asia. So I think people are hedging by looking to thicken up and diversify their other relationships. And I think that's going on with Japan, but also India and South Korea, Vietnam and Indonesia too.
Great. Anushir, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tyler.
You're listening to Monocle Weekly. We're back in Sydney in a moment. back with the Monaco Weekly here in Sydney. Now, this town might not strike you as the most obvious choice as a base if you're going to set out to launch a men's tailoring business, but it's exactly what the dashing Patrick Johnson is doing. In a country that's seen many of its traditional industries evaporate, like elsewhere in the developed world, what's it like starting from scratch? And might it have been better to stay in London? Patrick Johnson's here to tell us more. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. When we were chatting and we met on a very nice terrace in Amalfi this summer, which was fantastic, you were just packing your bags. You were leaving London. You've been back here now for almost half a year, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, a little bit longer, yeah.
And I guess sort of beforehand, you were obviously shuttling back and forth. You had a base of clients, for your bespoke business. With, I guess, a manufacturing base that sits in workshops, a bit UK, a bit in Holland,
yep.
Correct? And I'm wondering what you've found back here. Perhaps no surprises, but I'm interested in, is there a culture of craft? Because it seems there's plenty of good indigenous sort of communities, or I shouldn't say indigenous, but certainly immigrant communities. No shortage of Italians here, no shortage of Greeks, no shortage of Lebanese, all cultures that have had have great tailoring traditions. Is that what you're sort of looking at exploiting now that you're back?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there is a culture of craft here on that level, but it's not as structured as it is over in the UK. So there's the apprenticeship systems and all those kind of things aren't there. There's definitely some skill here, but it's not as established there and it's definitely not as advanced. But there's a culture of craft. I mean, since I've been back, I looked a lot at maybe setting up a workshop here and have sort of made roads into doing that. And it's quite hard for a few reasons.
List them.
Cost of machinery here, just general cost of setting up the Aussie dollars.
Right, doesn't help you right now.
It doesn't help. Well, it never really helped. It doesn't really help now, definitely. The cost of labour, the fact that there isn't really the skill set here at all. Yeah. And I kind of feel like it's been missed. In tailoring.
You mean sort of also a generation?
There are a couple of very good tailors down here. There's one very good one in Sydney, and he does it in the old traditional way. There's another one in Melbourne, and that's about it. There isn't this huge scope of, you talk about the little Italian guy in the corner. All those guys are 80 now. They're not really making suits anymore. So for that reason, it's a lot harder here. You can do simple stuff, shirts, and not that shirts are simple, but more basic stuff. Mm. But suits are very tricky here, and I've sort of thinking I might focus more on Europe. Yeah,
right. In terms of your manufacturing
exactly,
base,
exactly. Yeah.
Or what about Japan? I mean, we were talking about Japan as well.
I love Japan, and I'm heading to Japan in 2 weeks' time to have a look, and maybe mainly for shoemakers. Mm. They do some very good things in Japan, I think, and it's just a matter of forging the right relationships there. And with my tailors, I've been working with them for a very long time. They know what I'm like. I know what they're like, and we have a good understanding. And with tailors especially, and with a lot of craftsmen, it's not necessarily about the money why they do what they do. It's more about having a good relationship with someone and enjoying working with them. It takes a long time to build that up with someone. So if I did start in Japan, it's a 5-year prospect to sort of start to build a relationship. And I love Japan though, so I'm happy to go there.
Yeah, we all are. But on that point, I was at this conference in Singapore earlier in the week, and it was interesting because it was tourism focused. But one of the major credit card companies has done a body of work, and they talked about the most attractive markets for tourists. And I think they looked at sort of 6 non-Asian countries, and then there was probably sort of 12 Asian countries in the mix. But the two countries that emerged, and so whether you're in Thailand or whether you're in Indonesia, whether you're sitting in Taiwan, the two places that people really want to go are Australia and Japan. And I was thinking about it, and part of we were sort of unpacking this in one of the sessions at this conference, and people were sort of talking about a lot of very obvious things. And I said, what's interesting, I think, about both markets, if you look at sort of food culture here, very similar to Japan in many ways, because a real sort of emphasis on quality, sort of just this the diversity, I think, the way that it's a plethora of different cuisines down here. I think also the way that you can get an outstanding Japanese, you can get outstanding French, you can get outstanding everything in Japan as well. But part of what it is also this, I think this notion of the independently owned business as well, that, it's not sort of about sort of, massive chains. It's not about sort of bringing in the two-star chef from another part of the world, but it's really about sort of forging your own talent. And when I think about also what's happened with food in Japan, I also see the same thing with tailors too, that, suddenly, I mean, in the last probably 5 or 6 years, the amount of, probably guys who were working for, one of the major Japanese banks, they're working for Goldman Sachs or Macquarie or somebody in Tokyo, said, you know what, right, I've had enough, and I'm a clothes horse, and I'm going to And I've made my money as well. So you know what? Yeah. I can coast for a while. But I want to go and learn, you know, a skill and a craft. And so it's incredible to see that tailor boom in a way in Tokyo at a time when, of course, you know, the market is, you know, is very soft. But nevertheless, you see all of these small ateliers popping up. And I'm thinking sort of in the broader sense of sort of, you know, fashion in general, as you're saying, it is or is not easy to make a shirt. But, you know, do you think there's sort of the spirit down here to sort of make that happen?
Definitely amongst some people. I mean, I get a lot of younger guys inquiring, you know, I want to do some training and learn under you and all these things. But again, it comes back to you need a set apprenticeship system. And the Japanese, as you know, have a very different mentality to that sort of thing. They're happy to sort of sacrifice a little bit for their love and for their skill and all these things. In Australia, I don't see that as much, but it's definitely here, but it's not as obvious.
They're not going to sleep under the sewing machine.
We're not perfectionists like that. I mean, there's some amazing talent here. I mean, it is, and since I've come back, especially in prints and a lot in women's wear, you see it. And in tailoring, I don't see a lot because the barriers to entry are quite high. You have to do a lot of tailoring. You have to forge all these good relationships over in Europe. So you've got to go and do that and then come back. It's very hard to start here from scratch. So I'd like that to happen. That'd be fantastic if I'm getting all these bankers coming in. But I don't know if they know exactly what it involves. It's not the case of you might have to sell the BMW for a while or something. You know,
what are the cultural challenges? And they strike me as sort of obvious in terms of a client base because, you know, you don't have to make much of an effort here. And I don't mean that in a negative way. But, you know, if you've got sort of, you know, a decent build, you get some good denim and you can chuck on a T-shirt and you can put on some Havaianas and you've kind of done. And as long as you've got, you know, probably a decent tan, everything's sort of all right. And certainly, when you drive around downtown and you sort of see people come out of the major banks, et cetera, that, you know, it seems that there is sort of, you know, certainly the odd nattily dressed person, but it's interesting. I almost feel that the Aussies have actually not looked to Europe. They've looked to sort of Dress Down Fridays in America. And there's quite a big chino and, you know, Oxford cloth shirt culture. I know you're cringing over there, but there's a lot of it, isn't there?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, we've taken sort of Sprezzatura to the next level in Australia. Yeah. We're really dressing down. But, you know, magazines like Monocle and a few others, things like the Sartorialist and things, people are wanting to dress up a little bit more. You see a little bit more of that in Melbourne than in Sydney, but there's a lot of interest in it. And I get the internet's the best thing for this. I get these guys come in and they're sartorial geeks. I mean, these guys know so much. They know how jackets are constructed and they read up on this stuff and it's fantastic. And there's a lot of that here. The other thing I'd say is when a client, in comparison to London, when they come to you, there's very few preconceived ideas of the whole process. You know, whereas in London, their father may have had a tailor and la-di-da-da. So here and that's great from my point of view because you're starting with a sort of fresh canvas, you know, and you can give them all the options and there isn't this set structure. I have to have a navy suit and then a grey suit and we will have brass buttons on our casual jackets. So they're very open like that. So it can be a good thing as well. And it's just a matter of we've come from a very English culture, heavy clothes. They don't work down here. They just don't work. So the Japanese element coming in, the Neapolitan element coming in, and it's slow, but it's good. There's interest in it. So,
and what about expanding sort of beyond, obviously, just, you know, the core sort of made to measure? I mean, is there part of, you know, what you can do is also, you know, do an Orlebar Brown in a way, if you wanted to, and say, look, you know, there needs to be well-tailored trunks. And you mentioned sort of going up to Japan, you know, maybe for shoemaking, for example.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I like to, you know, sort of focus on what I think I'm good at and just work on that as much as I can, you know, like just slowly improve it every day. But there is definitely markets for all these things, but I think I can only do one thing at a time. Well, and then maybe when I'm a bit more established in that, but I do want to introduce some shoes because there just aren't any here. You go looking and there's a few shoe brands. I mean, it's amazing. I can't buy shoes here. You have to go on the internet. It's ridiculous. Right. So there are, but I think Oliver Brown does fantastic swim shorts.
You're not going to try to challenge them.
I don't think I can do any better.
No. I thought maybe there's a homegrown market though.
There is. But Billabong, there definitely is for all these things, and there's huge opportunity down here. It's a matter of not just copying someone else in Europe and actually looking at the thing and understanding it, and then improving it and making it better and putting it out in the market. Yeah.
Excellent. Very good, Patrick Johnson. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're with the Monocle Weekly in Sydney. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Sydney, where it's time for culture. And in the absence of our dear Robert Bound, We thought we'd invite one of our favourite Australian gallerists into the studio. Off the back of Frieze Week in London, we wanted to see what's hanging on the walls at Ian Dawson's gallery and better residences here and elsewhere in the world. Mr. Dawson joins us with his fine eye for emerging talent. Now, I thought before we talk about emerging talent, the first thing is, you know, early in the program, we had Robin Holt on, and she was, you know, we're chatting about, you know, the state of the economy, that things have been, you know, relatively good, which of course is probably always good news for someone owning a gallery. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, one of the things we were saying is, you know, just perhaps the negatives and the positives of remoteness, because, you know, you can't go off to see an exhibition, you know, in Paris, you know, in an hour and, you know, zip back and forth like you can in Europe or even in, you know, in some parts of the United States anyway. And I'm wondering, what does that do for young Australian artists? This, you know, is there a certain luxury in being in one of the more remote parts of the world?
I think definitely yes. I think that young artists here aren't pressured to kind of feel that they have to create a historical kind of point of view in their artwork. But I think it is a double-edged sword in that, you know, we don't get to kind of see these great artists on display in commercial galleries and in museums across the world, across Europe and North America. But we do have access to the internet, which is fantastic, and we can kind of see what's going on.
It's all been last year, right, that you got the internet here,
right? Yeah, I think it was 6 months ago.
Yeah, right.
Might I just say, Tyler, big shoes to fill on Rob Bounds behind.
I know. I mean, I think it's actually good that you've given Rob a week off, because as you probably, if you were listening to the show last week,
it was a
tough trawl for him. And even before we got on the plane to come down here, you know, it was sort of just, you know, the roundup of Frieze, and he was very much out on the tiles again.
It anyway. Sounded massive.
Yeah.
I can relate. I was up at Art Hong Kong earlier in the year, and I think there was 65 events over 4 days. So I know where he's coming from. But
I mean, when you mentioned Asia, I mean, you know, and Art Hong Kong, you know, is it, you know, are you noticing, and maybe we can sort of pair this with the state of the economy, are you, you know, certainly sort of making inroads? Is it part of your strategy to attract the big Korean families, the Japanese buyers that are still out there, and certainly the collectors in Hong Kong?
Absolutely. That's what I found so exciting about the Hong Kong Art Fair this year, was that there was a huge amount of interest up there. And Australia was very well represented by about 7 galleries up there, and they were selling very strongly. My personal strategy for the gallery is to take a stand at Art Hong Kong next year. I'm going to be taking just a solo show of an artist that I represent here from the Philippines, Mike Chavez. Really exciting to see that kind of response in Hong Kong from expats, but also from Chinese and people coming in from the regions to kind of see what was going on. But I think it was overwhelmingly positive.
If you could sum up, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, that you're representing an artist from the Philippines, let's say from your sort of curatorial eye, you know, what defines what you're interested in, and what's sort of attracting you? And if there's, you know, is there sort of a common narrative in terms of, you know, your own brand, in terms of, you know, what attracts people?
Well, I think the narrative is emerging, basically, starting there, but also just in a very fine art context. I mean, people want quality these days. I think that's been a big impact of the recession globally, but especially here, I think even though we have escaped, we're still looking for quality, or buyers are still looking for quality in the work. So, you know, years ago, you could sell a graffiti piece on a wall or on a bit of plaster and throw it on the wall, and that was fine. But I think people are looking for something that has a bit more longevity to it and has a prospect of some kind of investment value as well. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, is it easy for, and, you know, it was funny because we were chatting about, you know, again, things are sort of, you know, booming here. You know, it's not exactly cheap. And I was just, you know, having sort of, you know, your, you know, those lifestyle fantasies that I always have. And I was just spending probably too much time, you know, online last night, just looking at the price of property here. Decent value for money, but, you know, then giving it away. And so what does that mean for young artists? Is it still quite easy to get a great space down here? Do you think there's a level of support? And, you know, is it happening in Sydney, or is it happening in another city?
I definitely think it's happening in Sydney. Yes, you're right. Prices are driving artists out to the suburb a little bit more, the suburbs a little bit more. But I think also they're banding together, creating collaboratives. You're seeing a lot of artist-run initiatives popping up all over the place and group studios holding their own exhibitions and also kind of fostering support for those artists through the studio system, which is quite interesting as well. Sydney, I think, is very vibrant, very fantastic. It's Australia's international city, but I'm seeing a lot of interesting emerging artwork coming out of Brisbane, coming out of Queensland in general, and particularly the Gold Coast, which is quite fascinating.
And what do you think that is? Just sort of, you know, is it the commercial realities? Is it sort of, you know, I think what's interesting about, you know, the Gold Coast is obviously, you know, that this is, yeah, of course, it's sort of, you know, it's sunshine and it's booze and it's drugs and it's, you know, it's all of these things. And it's interesting, I guess, also, you know, that it's really this collision of, I think, also so many different cultures. I mean, you know, tourists,
absolutely,
package tourists are coming from Japan, probably meeting sort of, you know, the not so pretty side of Australia.
Exactly. And I think that's what artists are exploiting. They're exploiting that kind of cliched image of the bronzed Aussie and the golden bikini wearing meter maids off on the Gold Coast and talking about issues that do affect us as a culture. So I think they feel very free also. They're not kind of tied down by the teachings of particular art schools in Sydney, very established art schools in Sydney or Melbourne. And there's a sense of freedom about it, which I find really exciting.
Mm. Well, looking forward, you relocated and you're on Oxford Street. You used to be just off, but certainly sort of, you know, in, I guess, what is sort of defined as the gallery district. In Sydney. What about sort of, you know, in terms of also just local market, and, you know, do you have sort of a core of big families that also, you know, you rely on, that you hope
absolutely
the car pulls up?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'm not going to pretend it hasn't been tough the last couple of years. I mean, I started the business, you know, just when the GFC was starting. So, you know, in some ways a great time to start a business, but in most ways probably not. But I've found kind of moving to a larger premises on Oxford Street has given my gallery, but also my artists, a higher visibility. And that's what I'm about, is showcasing these unknown artists and hopefully turning them into known artists. And I think the more visibility you can give art and putting it in a shopping strip like Oxford Street really kind of brings it to the fore of people's minds. And that attention is really necessary, I think, at this point.
Finally, just on a media point of view, do you think that there is there enough down here? And, you know, earlier in the program, we were talking about just, you know, the cutbacks that so much of media has become so corporate, the challenges of also a small market. So it is, you know, it makes it quite difficult to make a go of it. If you're a smaller, independent media organization, does that... Yeah, I mean, are there enough outlets for you to get your message out there and your artists?
I don't think there's ever enough kind of mediums to kind of take advantage of in terms of getting out to the general public. I think there's some certain publications that are coming out that are of a really high quality, like The Monthly. I think there's great art reviews in there. That's fantastic. But I do rely heavily on the kind of mass media and the dailies to get the message across. And I do find it slightly disappointing that, you know, there isn't that support for the visual arts, say, as much as there is for restaurateurs and you know. And it's interesting you've got Bill Granger on the show today too. I mean, he's really kind of pushed that celebrity chef side of things. And I'd really love to see the art industry take a leaf out of their book and really push that as well.
Well, give us three artists. If someone's listening and is looking to invest in Australian art.
Only three Tyler.
Three names.
Three.
I mean, well, we can drive them to your website if you want as well. But three people you're really interested in at the moment.
Do that as well. But I'm really interested in Lionel Bowden's work as a sculptor and a painter. I'm interested in Brooke Andrews' work. He was recently featured at the Sydney Biennale this year. Fantastic work there. I'm interested in Fiona Omino, who's a young Indigenous artist from the Lockhart River community as well. So she's doing great paintings.
Okay, one more.
One more. From my gallery?
Yeah, why not?
I'm really enjoying the show I have on at the moment, Justin Cooper, and a sculptor called Troy Emery, who's doing very, very well. I'd love you to come and see them.
Okay, we'll do that. Hopefully we've got time after the show. Ian Dawson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tyler.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in Sydney. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where it's almost breakfast time, and that means it's great news because Bill Granger is here to guide us through the fine dining choices in this town and maybe even warm up his griddle. Did you bring it?
No.
I see it. I
know.
You tow it behind you.
Flip some scrambled eggs and...
we were talking during the break. It's the one remarkable thing, and I was saying this to Robin earlier in the program as well, is just... A couple of things I noticed. I was in your neighborhood, I guess, where you've got your place. I was sort of around Bondi and Bronte, and it's just something I don't see, you know, in many corners of Europe, is just the independent greengrocer, someone who's just focused on delivering, you know, good lettuces and many varieties of lettuces and also, you know, fantastic tomatoes. And that's what they do. They're not doing anything else.
No.
That's what they're focused on doing.
It's quite extraordinary that it still exists. And I really miss it when I'm not here. Being able to, and it's that access to good food, which is still very easy in Australia.
Mm.
It's not like you have to do it all through a big barrier of a big company. You can still get food from the source pretty easily.
Yeah, and I mean, it's amazing. We had a piece on, you know, that extraordinary new butcher that's here, which is, you know, sort of super, you know,
like the Cartier of
butchers. Yeah, I mean, it looks like sort of it's been designed by, you know, Katayama from Wonderwall in Japan. I mean, it's really, you know, that's amazing. You know, of course, then the sheer number of cafes, and it's just mouthwatering when you go.
And good coffee everywhere.
Just good coffee everywhere. Yeah. I mean, if you sort of talk about sort of, you know, cultural exports and soft power, and like even I was at Icebergs for lunch with Alex, and just like, you know, like Victoria Coffee, like how they're even like branding the cups with their five stars or whatever they do, but something really simple, really chic.
Mm.
Cups are also made in Italy, and it's great to sort of see sort of the depth and level. I think the only thing I'm missing, as I was saying, is just it's sad that there aren't more magazines. I mean, it's just, you know, there's kind of Gourmet Traveler. I mean, I don't know what you feel. It's kind of the only game in town now.
Yeah, there's not a lot of food. I mean, there's the mass food, the mass big sort of, you know, food. But the actual getting down and seeing what is really interesting that's happening isn't there so much anymore. Like the old Vargetang is gone, which is really sad. You know, things change. But online, there's a few things popping up now, I think.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, the other side where there is an opportunity down here, though, I couldn't believe I was in Double Bay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really felt last time I was here, like whatever, 4 years ago, that they were going to sort of, you know, overhaul that daggy Woolworths that's there.
Oh.
And, you know, you think, hey, this is the heartland where, you know, it is the epicenter of where there's cash in this country. And you think, you know, could you not sort of take a page from Coop in Switzerland, from, you know, Whole Foods, from Waitrose, and crank it up a gear?
I don't get why our supermarkets are so terrible. I come back here and I get
that's
spoiled.
The other side of it, isn't it? Because independent, brilliant.
Yes, which is great. Which is actually, and maybe that's the flip, because the supermarkets don't do a good job. So, or not doing as good a job as they could.
I mean, they could really...
Oh, look, you look at what's happening in, you know, even Waitrose, which spoils you. Because it's fantastic. You can actually buy great quality food.
Yeah.
And it's in a beautiful environment, and the staff love it, and they're really happy. And
you sort of wonder, like, do people from Woolworths and the other chains, do they not travel? Do they not get on planes? Because maybe they don't. I mean, maybe budgets are so tight.
Yeah, maybe
they're not looking at.
And maybe it works. You know, everyone works, and I think that it is that flipper. We have the big mass commercial supermarkets here that aren't good, but the independents fill that gap. And I think that's interesting. I think maybe if our supermarkets were better, we wouldn't have our independence.
Maybe
maybe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, you have to take one with the other.
Yeah.
Is what have you seen when you've been back in Sydney?
Yes.
So is this a new book? Is it a book tour for the upcoming?
Yes, I'm doing a book tour
at
the moment on Bill's Basics.
Yeah.
So I'm flying around, which is great to see. It's quite interesting in Australia. It's quite different from the rest of the world at the moment. It's still incredibly buoyant and optimistic and full of energy, which is quite unique at the worst, especially, you know, with what we've all gone through recently.
But there's an energy here that we were talking about this the other day. It's just that it's a nice sort of soft energy. It's not sort of frenetic and hyper. You just people are getting on with it, and I think that's, you know, that is one of the, you know, the great things is there is this pace of life. You're not sort of living under the oppression of sort of, you know, humidity. I mean, you've got seasons down here.
No, exactly.
It's not sort of that sort of slow pace that you get sort of towards the equator, but people just sort of get on with
it. It's that idea of lifestyle. That concept of lifestyle is so big in Australia, and you forget that when you're not here, that it's just so important to be out, you know, to be able to have time and sit outdoors, you know, on a milk crate outside a cafe and have a coffee and look at the paper.
Yeah.
And that's a thing you need to do on a Saturday morning. You can go and do that, and the sun shines, or you go for a walk on the beach, and all of those little things, which is very important. It does really, it really comes across in the Australian attitude to work, I think.
Yeah.
Like, we're very driven and we're really optimistic and we want to get things done, but it's also balanced with pulling it down a little bit, I think.
Yeah. What have you've been in Sydney, you've been down in Melbourne, seen anything new in terms of just emerging trends, talent?
I think what's happening with food is you're seeing there's two types of food. I mean, food in Australia, there's been MasterChef on TV. So there's a huge interest in food on the top level, really fancy. But I think what's interesting and what's happening on the street is it's getting back to basics, and things are really getting, you know, I went to a great wine bar last night. It doesn't have a name. Giovanni from Fratelli Paradiso has opened it in William Street in Paddington. Amazing. All he's doing is three dishes and organic wine, and that's it.
Wow.
I know. It hasn't got a name, brand, hasn't got a sign on the door yet.
Wow.
And it's fantastic. And then there's a great little restaurant called Bodega in Surry Hills, and they've opened a new one. I can't an Argentine grill. Mm. And they've got full lambs, full beasts and pigs over a fire pit in the middle of the restaurant. And you just get that carved up with salads.
Right.
Fantastic. Great. Yeah, you're really seeing a new energy coming through with food in Australia at the moment.
Because, and I think it's, as we were discussing earlier, is that it almost sort of felt like things, maybe the place got a little bit comfortable with itself.
Yeah, I think so. I think for a few years, nothing was interesting coming out. Probably after about 10 years ago, it started to slow that new thing. And I think things being a little bit more difficult is always interesting because it makes people try a lot harder and reassess what's working and what's not working and just throw it out a bit again. And I think Sydney's, we're at the cusp of, or Australia in general, of doing some interesting stuff again.
And then Melbourne, anything down there? I mean, you said you're a little bit excited about I'm getting on the plane tomorrow. Melbourne
amazes me with its energy. That just people, I don't know what it is in that city. It's just in its DNA, food and drink.
But is it the second city nature? Is it because it has four more pronounced, I think sort of Sydney is kind of winter and summer.
Yeah.
And there it is really four
and
seasons
I think
almost.
It's interesting because Melbourne is about the internal and Sydney's about the external. Sydney's right. A very physical city. It's about sitting outside and having a coffee or being outside, whereas Melbourne's about being inside, which therefore creates, the weather's not as good. So you're in having a coffee or you're out for a Sunday lunch, which you don't really do so much in Sydney. And that creates this great energy in the built environment. And I think that's why you get a lot more things that are a bit more avant-garde, a bit more interesting, and people try that a little bit harder. Mm. In Sydney, really, you just need to paint a room white, open a window.
Yeah, well,
that's all you need
to do. Yeah, it was interesting when we were talking to Patrick the Taylor earlier on as well, saying, it's the same thing with fashion down here as well. It's, he's doing his bespoke business. And then at the same time, you can look great in a pair of flip-flops and jeans.
Exactly, and a T-shirt, and that's all you need in
Sydney.
That's
a challenge.
It's a challenge as you get older.
But, it's incredible when you look at Melbourne as well, that they've got, there's this whole izakaya boom. Even people are just taking great derelict spaces and saying, I'm going to go do a Japanese pub. Remix it in the Melbourne style.
Yeah, yeah, and give it that cool edge. I met a great Japanese girl down there, and she'd married an Australian boy, and they were going and doing that same thing, and sort of bringing that. Melbourne always reminds me a bit of Japan and its built environment and its palette, the colour of the palette and the grey, the way stone and concrete is quite an important part of the built environment and it sort of works down there. They've got the same attitude to food. I always seen a lot of similarities between Japan and Melbourne. There's something going on there. I think it's that attitude to food, to design, to the beauty of what you're doing and really caring about that.
Do you feel when you're saying going back to basics as well? I'm also just wondering because certainly Australia is this extraordinary, in many ways sort of melting pot, but it's also a culture mosaic. I mean, people also really stick to their roots. And I think Melbourne is a very good example. Mm. Good bakeries still, that you can find sort of Polish bakeries and Hungarian bakeries and all of these things. Do you think that there's also sort of perhaps sort of looking a little bit more at more sort of, European cuisine as well? Because there has been, of course, just this massive influx and this is Asia as well.
Yes.
And do you think sort of one is winning out or there's everything sort of, maybe firing on the same amount of cylinders?
I think what's interesting in Australia is that in Australia, we are a cultural mix, and that's not unique in the world. Lots of countries are like that. But what's interesting in Australia is that we don't have a sense of foreignness or foreign food. The food becomes very much a part of who we are. So think about, and it's only in, we've only had influences from other countries for the last 50 years, so it's very new. But you don't, like even in the UK, you get a sense of foreign food or foreignness. You don't have that here. It's just who we are. So the Greek, the Italian, the Chinese, I think it all just sits so comfortably together. Not one really, it's not, where you had that Asian boom in the early 90s. Where, everything had to be timed. Mm. It's changed. It's much more even now where there's room for everything.
Is that also reflected in the new book as well? Because when I went through it, it's of course, just a lot of, let's say sort of, more sort of Western classics. But in a way that you also see some Asian things which have also really just become classics in Australia as well.
Yeah, they are classics. Like, a Luxor. I mean, I was up in the Northern Territory a year ago and I went to an old truck stop and, I was impressed this truck stop had a coffee machine, which was incredible. And they made a great coffee. So
right.
In the middle of nowhere.
I mean, you're talking about not just a percolator. You're talking about...
No, like a proper espresso machine where they, did a great coffee.
Wow.
Like a Bar Italia in London coffee. It was fantastic.
Right.
And then on the menu, they had meat pies, Australian classic, but a Luxor.
Yeah.
And this is the middle of an old truck stop in the middle of nowhere, like the most isolated place. And it just reminded me of how much this country's come and how much we mix food up, but make it very comfortable and normal. It's not just about fancy restaurants. It's about what real people eat in their homes all the time.
Is there already a second book on the horizon? I mean, no, I shouldn't say second book. You've had many books, but another book on the horizon.
Yes. Yeah. I'm quite obsessed with the whole, just Australia's position in Asia and how important that is to us and how we really have taken that Asian attitude of food and loving food and that very democratic notion of food, and we've really embraced that rather than that sort of idea of having it about being fancy. Australians love good food all the time, in the way that when you go to Singapore, you know, you'll go to, you know, hawk stands and the food's great everywhere. And Australians really embrace that attitude to food, and that's what I love about it.
I have one request. I mean, imagine you're probably, while you're here, you're probably staying at your joint.
Yeah.
But, I mean, don't you think there is room to do... I mean, of course, there's plenty of hotels. There's very nice hotels here, but there is room to do a new hotel in Sydney.
It needs it. I think it really needs it. I think Australia... I've just been travelling around it doing a book tour, and I really think Australia could do with a, you know, and I stay in, you know, London, I love the Soho, you know, Fernvale Group. It's fantastic. But that idea of another level hotel, it's a bit more personal, a bit more
Yeah, because everything is either, it's sort of design hotel a little bit on the cheap, and doesn't have the sort of, the full suite of services that you want.
Which you need with business as well. You need a little bit, you know, you need to know your internet's going to work, and you need a great concierge.
Absolutely.
And all of that.
No, and I'm looking for the hotel where I can literally have... like just part of the lobby, it's integrated with what you're saying. You know, there should be sort of milk crates out on the street, and you don't. And I think that's what's missing, is sort of they've really sort of nailed that, just, you know, stripping out all the pretension when you go into spaces. They're raw. They're just focusing on doing the right things. You thought, oh God, I wish someone would really just get the pool right, you know, get the bed right, and get the bathroom right, and then, you know, and just have, you know, just really easy cuisine in the lobby, and you're kind of done.
Oh, you're done. It's all, especially in Sydney. You know, someone wanted to stay here, and they're saying, "Where do we say we want a pool? Because you need a pool in Sydney." I mean, it's, you know, it's warm. You want to lie by the pool, and when you haven't got meetings, but it's hard. It's very.
I mean,
hard.
Even, you know, it's like, you know, we're at the Park Hyatt this time, and it's just, you know, the pool's kind of tiny. Well, it hasn't also been weather for it, but it's just, you think, okay, there's room to do it, guys. So anyway, the onus is all on you. Exactly. Well, that's all for this week. Edition of the Monocle Weekly. Thank you very much, Bill. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Simon Braithwaite here at the ABC in Sydney. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. Issue 38 is now at our newsstands in most markets, so do grab a copy if you want to know how to run a family business. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. Next week, we'll be back in London finishing our bumper December-January issue. But for now, from Sydney, I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Bill Granger.
More next week from London. Goodbye.